Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices, move on to business and sports, finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. Just one death notice in today's Arizona Republic, John M. Santandrea, age 70, from Glendale. Date of death was February 4th, 2026. There's a note that says, if you have any information regarding this person or happen to be a relative, please call 602-506-5801. That number is 602-506-5801 if you have any information about John M. Santandrea. Turning now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic, the top of the page headline, reduced immigration slows job growth. U.S. has added just 181,000 positions in 2025. The recent drop in unauthorized immigration to the United States has slowed employment growth, particularly in construction and manufacturing. And those trends are likely to continue. New research from the San Francisco Federal Reserve, published on February 17th, shows. The study looked at the rapid rise in unauthorized immigrants beginning in 2021 and the slowdown that began in March 2024, and found that local job growth grew and then shrank in lockstep with those immigration trends. The findings could have important implications for the job market outlook and for housing affordability. Revisions to jobs data published last week showed the U.S. economy added only 181,000 jobs in 2025, a fraction of the 1.459 million jobs added in 2024, the final full year of former President Joe Biden's term. Economists have linked the slowdown to the sharp drop in immigration, but this latest study helps make that link concrete by its detailed analysis of unauthorized worker inflows and the impact on local labor markets. On average, places experiencing the biggest slowdowns in unauthorized immigration saw the biggest slowdowns in employment growth in construction, manufacturing, and other services, wrote Fed economists Daniel Wilson and Xiaoqing Zhao. The Trump administration has said the reduction in immigration will benefit American workers and will help make housing more affordable by reducing demand for homes. And continuing with the business section, Medicare Advantage plans see disruption. Study finds nearly 3 million had to switch coverage. Nearly 3 million people with Medicare Advantage plans, or about 10% of all enrollees in the privately managed program, had to find alternative coverage in 2026 as health insurers exited the markets and scaled back plan options, according to a study published in a medical journal on February 18th. Members in rural areas experienced plan disruptions at double the rate of those in urban areas, the JAMA study found, raising concerns about losing access to health care providers, specialty care, and long-term treatments. Hannah Jones, a policy researcher at the think tank RAND Corporation, wrote in an editorial accompanying the study. In seven states, more than 40% of Medicare Advantage enrollees were left scrambling as plans exited, including 92% of enrollees in Vermont. The others were Idaho, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Maryland, and New Hampshire. The government's Medicare health program provides benefits to about 60 million people age 65 or older or who have disabilities. About half of them enroll in Medicare Advantage plans run by major health insurance companies, while the other half receive benefits from traditional government-run Medicare. In 2025, health insurance companies reported shortfalls in plans after costs rose and government reimbursement declined. Enrollees of smaller insurance carriers represented half of those experiencing disruptions, the study found. United Healthcare, part of United Health Group, accounted for nearly 14% of disruptions, followed by CVS Health's Aetna and Elevance at 8.65% and about 8%, respectively. Plans that had provided consumers with greater choice in providers were most frequently terminated, the study also found. The current model, in which government pays insurers on a pre-negotiated basis, incentivizes insurers to attract more profitable patients, James said in her editorial. Policymakers should consider whether the current program design adequately aligns plan incentives with beneficiary needs, James said. In 2025, United Healthcare accounted for nearly a third of all Medicare Advantage plans, according to health policy firm KFF. Humana, CVS Health, and Elevance accounted for 17%, 12%, and 7% of the plans, respectively. And the final article on the business section today, industry pours millions into snack rebrands. Companies invest in products tailored to users of GLP-1 drugs. Global food and beverage companies like PepsiCo and Coca-Cola are focusing on shorter ingredients lists and smaller pack sizes in 2026, aimed at consumers of appetite-suppressing GLP-1 drugs for weight loss. So far this year, nearly three dozen companies outside the healthcare industry have mentioned GLP-1 drugs or weight loss on their earnings conference calls, up from 14% the same period a year ago, and just 5 2 years earlier, according to LSEG data. Diet changes linked to GLP-1 drug use could mean up to $12 billion in snack sales lost over the next decade, according to EY Parthenon estimates. Adoption of GLP-1 drugs, which suppress appetite and are mainly prescribed for diabetes and weight loss, more than doubled in the 12 months to December, with about 20% of U.S. households now including at least one user, according to PwC analysis. Peter Terkulve, CEO of Magnum Ice Cream, said GLP-1 users continue to eat treats, but they exhibit a stark reduction of mindless munching and binge eating. Coca-Cola's incoming top boss urged faster innovation on his first analyst call as CEO-elect last week, while Kraft Heinz's new chief halted a planned split of the company and instead announced $600 million in investments this year to revive long-neglected staples such as its meat and cold cuts business, Oscar Mayer. Capital expenditure is expected to rise for most big food companies this year, jumping as much as 23% for General Mills, according to LSEG data. PepsiCo has launched a line called Simply NKD, or Simply Naked, I guess, to reformulate its snacks, such as Lay's and Gatorade, by removing artificial colors and flavors while also embracing smaller portion sizes. I think there are more opportunities than threats, but there are both, PepsiCo CEO Ramon Laguarta said on a post-earnings call last week. Coca-Cola ramped up production to meet growing demand for its protein-infused Fairlife milk last year. General Mills launched higher-protein Cheerios cereal in December 2024 as it grapples with the competition for breakfast foods. We expect GLP-1 and other anti-obesity drugs to have a lasting influence in the food and nutrition landscape, nudging some consumers towards smaller portions and more nutrient-dense protein and fiber-forward foods, the company's CEO Jeffrey Hammerning said at the Consumer Analyst Group of New York conference on February 17th. Conagra Brands is investing in snacks such as Slim Jim meat sticks, nuts and seeds, and issued a report last year that highlighted rising demand for protein-forward, portion-controlled, and nutrient-dense foods, especially among Gen Z and millennials. There's not anyone out there that's not designing, putting research and development dollars against this trend, said Peter Mangan, managing director at Portage Point Partners. Smaller businesses are seeing the opportunity as well. Snap Kitchen, a private Austin-based company that provides curated daily meals to roughly 35,000 customers annually, invested in expanding its menu with lean protein with products containing higher fiber, lean protein density, and ingredients shown to promote fullness to reflect changing tastes, said CEO Mitchell Raich. The GLP-1 opportunity has sharpened our focus and accelerated our pipeline, Raich said. GLP-1 users, on average, consume 40% fewer calories, according to PwC's analysis data from consumer insights firm Numerator. Dessert consumption is down 84%, and alcohol use is down by 33%, while fresh produce intake is up by more than 70%. Family grocery baskets are 4% to 6% smaller, according to the data, while single-person households have experienced declines of up to 9%. We're just starting to scratch the surface on the ripple effects of this type of physiological disruption, said Ali Furman, PwC's U.S. consumer markets leader. Turning now to the sports section of today's Arizona Republic, the big headline at the top of this first page, Cactus League is back. What you might not know about navigating the Cactus League, Bob McManaman, columnist for the Arizona Republic. The 2026 Cactus League season is upon us, and whether you've been a longtime loyal attendee to spring training games in Arizona, an occasional enthusiast, or just a curious first-time fan, there are always some useful tips you can use to make it the best experience possible. The abbreviated schedule for Friday, February 20th, marks the beginning of Cactus League games in Arizona. Baseball fans can catch the Chicago White Sox at the Chicago Cubs at 1:05 p.m. at Sloan Park, the Kansas City Royals at the Texas Rangers, 1:05 p.m. at Surprise Stadium, the Diamondbacks at the Rockies at 1:10 p.m. at Salt River Fields, and the San Diego Padres at the Seattle Mariners at 1:30 p.m. at Peoria Sports Complex. Before we delve straight into it with some helpful hints from us here at the Arizona Republic, let's take a moment to reflect on what makes attending a Cactus League game in the Valley such a wonderfully fun rite of passage. For starters, the always reliable sunshine, the slathering on of sunscreen, and the slurping down of the suds and occasional margarita. Deeper than that, it's about getting a chance to follow your favorite team and players and chasing autographs and taking pictures, all while being in a smaller, far more intimate setting than you'll normally experience during the Major League season in a loud and crowded Major League Baseball stadium. In spring training, you're so much closer to everything. You can hear just about everything that's being said and shout around the diamond, from the players to the skippers and the umps. Sometimes that can be worth the price of admission alone. So is catching the batting practice and pregame workouts on the backfields, if you arrive early enough. And don't forget, it's also the perfect opportunity to teach that special someone how to keep score for the first time, meet some new folks, and maybe catch a foul ball and get a glimpse of a prospect who might someday become a superstar. It's also very likely you might run into one of the legends of the game, as teams regularly invite some of their former greats to attend spring training, and sometimes even make them available for autographs and meet-and-greet sessions. For additional fun, check every team's website and be on the lookout for contests, giveaways, and special events. With that, here are some of our recommendations under the billing 2026 Cactus League Made Easy. Purchasing tickets. Our advice is to buy them early, usually online through the designated teams or venues you'll be visiting. Search for coupons and discounts whenever applicable. Prices vary by ballparks and seating locations, so scan them all to find your comfort range. Because weekend games tend to sell out quickly, try to squeeze in a few games during the weekdays for more convenience and a chance to spread out and relax. Another way of enjoying a casual ball game on a budget is by opting for more affordable outfield berm areas on the grass. don't forget to bring a blanket. And parking situations. It depends on the ballpark, but four of them that house two major league teams offer free parking. Other venues vary in price, and usually it's in the nominal range. One piece of advice, though, get there early if you're driving, so you don't have too far to walk. Ride sharing also works, but we suggest planning ahead to see where your drop-off and pickup spots are located. Again, it varies from ballpark to ballpark. There are also various park and ride options to consider at various locations. What to bring and don't bring. Just use your basic common sense here, and keep in mind you can expect bag checks and metal detectors at stadium entrances. Items to bring include sunscreen, hats, sunglasses, comfortable shoes, and one sealed plastic or reusable water bottle, up to 1 liter per person. If you're hoping to get some autographs, don't forget a Sharpie, a baseball or two, or a program or jersey you can purchase in the team shop. Bring a baseball glove for those foul balls, too. Clear, small bags, generally under 16 by 16 by 8, usually are allowed, but ballparks prohibit large bags, coolers, glass containers, and any form of alcohol. Diaper bags and medical bags are allowed, but aerosol cans, noise-making devices, and especially weapons of any kind are strictly forbidden. Typically, most places don't mind if you bring an array of small snacks in that clear small bag, but again, check each stadium's policies just to be safe. Children's entertainment. Depending on their ages, a baseball game in the afternoon or in the evening, when they also play on occasion, might be a tad difficult to hold a kid's attention. Never fear. There's usually always something during the Cactus League season to help occupy the youngsters' time. Some of our spring training ballparks feature kid zones or play areas with fun events and games to help keep the little ones occupied. Just make sure you don't leave them unattended, of course. And when you happen to see the friendly team mascot around your seating area, feel free to wave them over for a selfie or two. On those especially sunny days, or the rare chance of rain showers, consider seats in covered, shaded areas where available. And when paying at the ballpark, remember that just about every facility is cashless, which means you'll have to rely on your plastic fantastic, meaning either a debit card or a credit card, but you can also use your mobile wallet via cell phone. Sometimes things can get pricey, but don't fret. Hey, you've planned for this, and you are prepared. And continuing with baseball, Diamondbacks outfielder Thomas is entering crossroads season with a new swing. Alec Thomas arrived at Diamondbacks camp with a different swing, a quieter swing. Gone is the pronounced leg kick. In its place is a simpler, more muted step. For years, Thomas had been unsure about making this sort of change. He felt this winter the time had finally come. There was success with the leg kick, but it was never consistent, and it hasn't been consistent for the past 4 years, Thomas said. Talking with the hitting coaches and people I work with as well, it was, what can I do to get myself the best chance? I just thought. And then hitting coaches thought, and this would probably be the best thing to do. The old swing was the one he used to hit one of the bigger home runs in club history, a game-tying shot off Phillies reliever Craig Kimbrell to tie Game 4 of the National League Championship Series in 2023. It was also one that generated so many ground balls to the right side over the past few seasons, swings on which his timing was just slightly off. He is hoping his new mechanics buy him a little more time to recognize pitches and thus cut down on chase while staying balanced and on time. Through the early days of camp, he's liking how everything is feeling. Now, I know what Geraldo Perdomo feels like when he's going from 0-2 all the way back to 3-2, and I see it a lot longer and am able to recognize it a little better. Like today, he continued, talking about live batting practice sessions against teammates, I felt like I saw a lot of pitchers and was able to lay off pitches that maybe I wouldn't have in the past, and I was facing some pretty good guys as well. I feel good right now with it. I've just got to trust it and continue to have faith with it. In parts of four seasons in the majors, Thomas owns just a 234, 277, 362 line. He has had stretches of success, but has struggled to maintain it, and he never posted strong numbers against left-handed pitching. He finds himself in a different situation in spring training, and his career might be at a sort of crossroads. He's penciled in as the starting center fielder, but might find himself in competition with former top prospect Jordan Lawler, who is moving to the outfield. Thomas also is being asked to be available to bounce to the outfield corners with left fielder Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and right fielder Corbin Carroll dealing with injuries that could land them on the injured list to start the season. Moreover, the center field defense that Thomas provided early in his career hasn't been as exemplary over the past two seasons, likely the result of a hamstring injury that not only took a long time to heal, but also played mind games with Thomas once he got back on the field. He says he's overcome the mental hurdles the injury created and appreciates the importance the upcoming season might have on his career. "I'm not going to put a bunch of pressure on myself, but I definitely have a lot more faith and confidence in myself, and I've just got to trust everything," he said. "It's going to work out the way it's supposed to. It took me 4 years to realize that I've got to change something, but I think the change is good. It can be good. I'm really excited about what's to come this season." Thomas certainly had his moments with the old swing. It's part of why he was hesitant to change. He tried to implement a similar adjustment a few years ago when he was sent to the minor leagues, but he found the change to be too difficult to implement in season. When he watches his old swing on video, he marvels at how he made it work. "Whenever I was really good, it was like, dang, I can just hang up there and see the ball well," he said. "But whenever I was doing bad, everything was kind of out of whack. I don't want to have too many highs and lows. Well, I'd love the highs, but the lows, I feel like the lows were pretty low. I'm just trying to find that middle ground. I feel like this gives me a better chance. For me, at this point, I've just got to trust and believe that it will work." And periodic rain and cooler temperatures made for schedule changes in the Diamondbacks' daily workout at spring training on Wednesday, February 18th. But the rain that fell in North Scottsdale wasn't enough to deter the work that manager Torrey Lovello said the players needed to get done. Lovello stopped by hitting groups on the backfields at the team's Salt River Fields complex, urging the players to get in their work before calling it a day. "Doing baseball things in adverse conditions can only help the Diamondbacks when they go back east to ballparks without a roof to fend off the rain. There was some rain in Washington, D.C. last April when the team traveled there, and in June, rain caused a game suspension and delays in Cincinnati. The most exciting part of the day for me was being able to work in the rain," Lovello said. "We don't get a chance to do that very often here. With rain coming down, I was super fired up about that. We got great infield work, and the infielders need to learn how to pick up a ground ball and work it around the infield when the ball's not perfect." Lovello said none of the pitchers in the expected starting rotation are going to start the first game of spring training on Friday, February 20th. He said it's going to be a youngster, yet to be named, who will get the call. "That won't affect the buildup of the big league starters," he added, "as they will ramp up their pitch counts with each outing of the spring. Those players headed for the World Baseball Classic will be given the opportunity to play a lot of spring training games early, possibly back-to-back games if they feel good about doing that." "How often, I'll leave that to them," Lovello said. "I'm going to manipulate the lineups a little bit to give them that opportunity to go out and be as ready as possible." And turning to basketball, GM says Phoenix is in a good place in final stretch. Less than 12 months after the Phoenix Suns decided to dismantle their Big Three and pivot to a new era, general manager Brian Gregory thinks the team is in a good spot. Gregory spoke on two topics before taking questions during media availability at the Verizon 5G Performance Center on February 18th, first thanking Nick Richards and Nigel Hayes-Davis, who were traded to the Milwaukee Bucks before the deadline, for their time with the Suns, and then diving into the bigger picture. The Suns acquired guards Amir Coffey and Cole Anthony from Milwaukee, Coffey has played limited minutes so far, while Anthony has yet to report to the team prior to the All-Star break. Last spring, in the preseason, right before the first game, we talked about building a new identity and creating a culture based on toughness, grit, selflessness, Gregory said. We made the decision when we talked about it openly that our success wasn't going solely to be defined by wins and losses, but more importantly, by building the daily habits and the behaviors that were going to drive those characteristics that hopefully defined our team. The Suns fired coach Mike Budenholzer in April after a disappointing 36-46 season and failing to make the playoffs, making the third coaching change in as many years. In early June, the team hired Jordan Ott, a top assistant with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Then the Suns traded forward Kevin Durant to the Houston Rockets on June 22nd, which brought Jalen Green and Dylan Brooks to Phoenix. After that, the Suns agreed to a buyout with guard Bradley Beal in July, who had $110 million in 2 years remaining on his contract. Since then, the Suns have been one of the surprise teams in the league, sitting at seventh place in the Western Conference at 32-23 ahead of their game February 19th against the San Antonio Spurs in Austin. Phoenix is only 2 games back of the Rockets, who are in fourth. I think we're in a good place. I think we've made progress in all of those areas. I think our fans, our great community of Phoenix, and maybe even you guys can feel it a little bit, Gregory said, referring to the media. We've made the changes. We're moving in the right direction. I like the spot we're in, he said. While Gregory was in a reflective mood and had just finished praising Coach Jordan Ott and the team, he was also quick to note that the NBA is fragile. He even pushed back when asked what it was like to see the payoff from the decisions made in the summer. I think payoff is too strong of a word because we're still in the process, but it's a good feeling, Gregory said. To see our competitive level and the joy that our players play the game with, that's rewarding. And like I said, in this league, there are going to be some nights that are deemed a failure in terms of wins and losses. Keeping our eye on where we want to go and how we get there has been very rewarding. Gregory says the success so far of the season won't have an impact on the team's timeline moving forward. I don't think it speeds anything up, Gregory said. I think what it does is make the ride a little more enjoyable, you know? Guard Jalen Green, who has only appeared in 7 games this season due to a right hamstring injury, is progressing well, Gregory said. Green last played on February 10th against the Dallas Mavericks, scoring 12 points in 20 minutes as the Suns have been easing him back onto the court after his latest setback, in which he tweaked the hamstring and also bruised his hip during a hard fall. You want to make sure that things are in the right place for not only Game 1, but also Game 20, and then for the entire career. His work ethic has matched anything that we needed, and now I think he's good to go. Gregory thinks Devin Booker and Green can become one of the best, if not the best, backcourts in the NBA. That confidence stems directly from the head coach. We are creating environments here where players come in and they know they're going to have career years during their time here in Phoenix, Gregory said. That's very important, not only for our current players, but as we move forward into the future as well. That's a piece that comes from the coaching. There's a piece that comes from our operations staff, from our medical staff. All those things are critical in building what we want to build and sustaining that as well. And turning to football now, LaFleur defends choice of Hackett for OC role. In selecting their offensive coordinator, the Arizona Cardinals, and specifically head coach Mike LaFleur, opted for experience, hiring Nathaniel Hackett. And as NFL experience goes, that means embracing the positives and negatives. Hackett was once seen as a rising star in the industry. In 2017, he helped lead the Jacksonville Jaguars to the AFC Championship game with Blake Bortles at quarterback. 2 years later, he landed in Green Bay, where he oversaw 3 of the league's best offenses in 3 years with the Packers. But since then, the ride has been turbulent. Hackett's tenure with the Packers, when he did not call offensive plays, landed him his first head coaching job with the Denver Broncos. That lasted just 15 games before he was dismissed with a 4-11 record. His next stop was with the New York Jets, where he called plays. In both seasons there, his offenses were bottom 10 units. So that was the background on Wednesday, February 18th, when LaFleur was asked to explain the discrepancy between Hackett's success as a non-play calling offensive coordinator and his failures as a play caller. But LaFleur, who will call the offensive plays in Arizona, pushed back. "He's been very successful," LaFleur said. "He's very highly thought of, particularly within our profession. You guys believe one thing from this press conference. It is, literally, I wanted him and nobody else, and he's here." LaFleur also rejected the notion that Hackett was not successful in Denver and New York. "There's so many factors in success and not," Fleur said. "It's like, define success. I get what you're going to say, wins and losses. Well, I would say sometimes it's a little bit more than that with the variables that are in place in the NFL. But in Arizona, LaFleur's job and Hackett's will be to overcome those external factors, reversing the fortunes of a moribund franchise. In Arizona, Hackett will return to the role he held with the Packers, a non-play-calling offensive coordinator. It's a job that ostensibly carries diminished importance. The head coach is the public-facing centerpiece of an organization, while the play callers are often credited with all that goes right, or wrong, on their side of the ball. But in LaFleur's mind, that's a simplistic way to view the coaching staff. At times, I think the play caller gets maybe a little too much credit, LaFleur said. There's so much work that goes into what goes into building the foundations up until that first game in September. Throughout the week, LaFleur explained the coaching staff is working together to construct a game plan all the way up until Sunday morning, when they make final decisions about situational play calling. The offensive coordinator is a crucial piece of that operation. It's setting the table, setting the menu, having great energy around the building, LaFleur said, having great communication when I'm doing stuff with the defense and when I'm doing stuff with Monty, when I'm doing stuff just around the building. Hackett echoed that belief. "My goal, no matter what the role is that the entire staff understands the plan and can call the game the exact same way," Hackett said. "That's really, in essence, what you're looking for. It doesn't matter who's got the paper. It doesn't matter who's got the microphone to the quarterback. It's everybody's going to call it the same way." Hackett knows that his tenures with the Broncos and Jets didn't go well. No one wants a 16-33 record over three seasons. So what did he learn from those stops? "Well, learn from your adversity," Hackett said, "and expect adversity. We always talk about that. But I think, again, it's how you view that adversity. You can let it bring you down, and I've always been somewhat known as an energetic human being, and no matter what, don't change. Be yourself." Those are lessons that Hackett can pass on to LaFleur, as the only coach on this staff who has had head coaching experience in the NFL. "Help him maybe not do some of the things I've done," Hackett said, "and do some of the things I've done. After all, this was a key part of the reason that LaFleur wanted Hackett in town. Experience in all walks of life is huge," LaFleur said. And turning now to college basketball. This was a game on Wednesday, number 4 Arizona 75, number 23 BYU 68. For much of the season, off to the side of his team's historic 23-0 start, Arizona coach Tommy Lloyd was constantly dishing out patience to some of his players. At least in his public explanations, Lloyd offered plenty of encouragement to Anthony Dell'Orso that his shooting would come around when the Wildcats need it. Lloyd told high-potential but long-term prospect Sidi Guyai in December after using him only sparingly to start getting ready for a big game appearance in about 4 weeks. It actually took a little over 8 weeks, but more on that later. And Lloyd apologized to grad transfer guard Evan Nelson, saying earlier this season that he had to sit him while he developed his freshman instead. The player-coach talks were quite a bit different this week. before the number 4 Wildcats beat number 23 BYU 75-68 at McHale Center on Wednesday, February 18th, Lloyd had meetings with his team and individuals. Some of the words may have been obvious. Help was needed, ASAP, with starting forward Koa Pete out with a lower leg strain, reserve forward Dwayne Aristode out for what Lloyd called a short while with an unspecified illness, and starting guard Braden Burries trying to play through some other sort of illness. But there was something of urgency to get across. Roles needed to be discussed, accepted, and excelled in. If the Wildcats were to avoid heading into a first-place showdown with Houston on Saturday, February 21st, on a 3-game losing streak. Typically, Lloyd described it all in measured tones. We had conversations, for sure, but it wasn't anything, you know, the house wasn't on fire, he said. We met because obviously we had to get our collective thoughts together to figure out what we needed to do, have a different rotation, look at some different actions at both ends of the floor. We wanted to make sure that we were efficient. We weren't just spraying darts. The result was visible immediately against BYU. While sixth man Toby Waka predictably moved into Pete's starting role, Gay was in the game after less than 4 minutes, making a highly unusual primetime appearance. Gay first came to replace center Motijus Krivas after the first 3 minutes, while Nelson hit the floor just over 2 minutes later to play alongside Jaden Bradley on the perimeter. Meanwhile, Dell'Orso appeared with Gay and hit his first three-pointer with just 32 seconds after that. Dell'Orso finished with a season-high 22 points, his best overall three-point shooting effort since he went 4 for 7 from 3 and scored 20 points in UA's 69-65 win over UCLA on November 14th. Maybe it looked like a sense of urgency. The moment was exactly the sort of push Dell'Orso needed to break out of the shooting slump he's had most of the Big 12 season. But, as always, expressing confidence in his straightaway style, Dell'Orso said that really wasn't the case. "Nah, really no," Dell'Orso said. "I mean, I could say some brought on answer, but I go out every game like I can do it every time." Lloyd pretty much has said as much about Dell'Orso, defending his Aussie wing consistently during some rough stretches. While Dell'Orso scored in double figures regularly and shot 33.3% from three-point range during non-conference play, he entered the BYU game shooting only 23.5% from beyond the arc. That's 8 of 34. He had shown signs of a breakout coming, hitting 3 of 8 three-pointers over UA's previous 3 games after making just 5 of 27 threes in 9 Big 12 games before that. But against the Cougars, Dell'Orso not only hit 4 of 8 three-pointers, but went to the basket aggressively on several occasions, including a game-sealing dunk with 32 seconds left off a feed from Bradley. "I keep telling you guys, I'm no panic," said Dell'Orso, Lloyd said. "I think Delly is going to be ready to deliver when we need him the most. Obviously, I couldn't have predicted it 2 or 3 weeks ago, but today there was a significant need, and he stepped up." Dell'Orso's shooting helped the Wildcats hit 9 of 21 threes against BYU, fifth most shots they've taken beyond the arc all season, having become known for preferring to pound the ball inside and make more free throws than their opponents attempt. BYU, 13 of 16, made more free throws than UA took, 8 of 12, and the Cougars also outscored the Wildcats in the paint, 30 to 26. It was a different game. The Wildcats were a different team. "I felt that we needed to shoot a few threes," Lloyd said. "I know you guys think I'm anti-three, and that's fine. I'll wear that. But I felt like we got some good looks, especially in the first half. I thought in the second half we should have taken a few more. It's hard for me when I look at the number and I see more three-point attempts than free-throw attempts. But that's what the game called for, and luckily we knocked down 9 of them." Dell'Orso said afterward that it feels great, but said that it was true for everyone, with so many others playing well in a time of particular need. "It's good to get a win like that at home, after the week we went through," he said. The Wildcats' other contributors included different ones and regular ones who were different. Ivan Karchenkov, the often demonstrative starting wing from Germany, slipped in 18 points on 7-for-12 shooting and pulled down 7 rebounds, maybe before anybody knew it. Ivan has a quiet 18, is really efficient, and plays some great defense, Lloyd said. Big-time effort by him. Gay played just 10 minutes, but his presence was unusual and impossible to ignore. The lanky freshman from Senegal had 4 points, 4 rebounds, and a steal, but 3 fouls in 10 minutes. He drew wild applause during a second-half sequence in which he threw in an alley-oop dunk off a feed from Bradley and then put in a basket on his offensive rebound. The 4-week wait had turned into 8 weeks, but it was a big game that Gay was finally a part of. An opportunity arose, and CD did a great job, Lloyd said. Our guys practice with him every day. They know how he can impact the game around the rim and how he can catch lobs. So I was really happy for CD. That was really kind of a shot in the arm for the crowd and for our team. Nelson didn't get quite as noticeable a reaction and didn't get to play at all in the second half, but he did hold his own during four first-half minutes with a rebound and a steal. Evan played great, Lloyd said. He probably could have gotten another run. It's just how we were managing the game in the second half that he didn't get one. I think he's going to get a few more opportunities here in the next week or so, and I'm sure he'll take advantage of them. And continuing with college sports, wealthy donor will aid funding for Sun Devils' indoor football facility. Arizona State football coach Kenny Dillingham drew some criticism in December when he called for a wealthy donor to come forward to help the Suns program take the next giant step. Well, it worked. A big donor has indeed come forward with a major donation that Dillingham said will go toward a new indoor football facility. Dillingham, who just completed his third year heading the program, confirmed this on February 19th when he appeared on the Bickley and Murata show on Arizona Sports 98.7 as part of its Newsmakers Week. Dillingham said the ASU indoor practice facility, to be built adjacent to Mountain America Stadium, will feature a half field in addition to a full football field, with the full field completely indoors. It will be one of the largest in the country. Dillingham did not name the donor or the amount of the gift. Somebody who's not naturally associated with the program, but somebody associated with the Valley, so that's trending in the right direction, he said in describing the benefactor. In December, he insisted there was someone wealthy enough in Phoenix who could step up and stroke a $20 million check for the program. He didn't identify anyone specific at the time. Dillingham on Thursday noted that he called for an 8-figure donor in December and added that this was somebody very close to that. The new facility will be used for daily practices, which is particularly important when the team is training in the hottest months of the season. The current facility on the east side of Rural Road features an indoor field and is often referred to as the bubble. Players either have to walk the short distance from the stadium or go back and forth on golf carts, raising safety concerns. Having a facility adjacent to the stadium, locker rooms, and weight room will also save time. The plans call for the facility to double as a tailgating area for game days. Athletic Director Graham Rossini, who also appeared on the morning show, has said multiple times that one of his biggest goals is to improve the fan experience. Dillingham also said there are other potential uses for the facility, such as hosting youth football events. Dillingham has shunned overtures from other football programs that have had head coaching openings in the last 2 years, citing his commitment to building something at his alma mater in the area where he grew up. He signed a restructured contract, and the university increased the pool of money for his assistant coaches, which is now toward the top of the Big 12. The community has responded, too, with ASU selling out every home game in the 2025 season. Every year I have challenged the administration to get better, like we're trying to get better, and I think they did it again, he said. We're nowhere near where I want to be as a program, but every year we've taken steps. I'm fully aware this isn't going to go from where we were to like the top of where I want to go overnight in terms of all the resources and all that, but we are absolutely taking steps and making strides every single year. So I feel really, really good about what the university is doing. And we've got some high school basketball playoff news. Central advances in open division playoff game. John Mattingly had 31 points, but made just one field goal in the final quarter. It was a big one, a well-defended jumper as he was falling down inside the arc that gave the number 21 seed Central a 79-70 lead with a minute to play in the Bobcats' 82-72 victory on February 18th over host and number 12 seed Arcadia in an open division high school basketball playoff game between the two Phoenix schools. The Bobcats, however, may have been heading back to the 5A bracket had it not been for John Farndorf and Darion Thomas coming through with big shots behind the arc in the final quarter. "Just stay focused," Farndorf said. "I know I can hit my shot when it comes. I hit three tonight to close it out. That's what I need to do to help our team win." Farndorf knocked down three of his four three-pointers in that decisive quarter, and Thomas made just his second three-pointer of the season, as Central, who's 27-2, advanced to play at number 5 Phoenix Sandra Day O'Connor on February 20th in the second round of the 32-team Open Division State Basketball Tournament. Arcadia, 20-6, falls back into the 4A Conference playoffs, which begin next week. Central, despite being seeded 21st, is ranked at number 6 in the Arizona Republic's latest Super 10 of the best teams in the state. Farndorf's first three of the final quarter gave Central, who are 27-2, a 68-62 lead with 6 minutes, 2 seconds left. Central's Dominic Rojas, who had 9 points, then fouled out. A technical was assessed to the Central bench. Arcadia turned that into 3 points to come within 68-65. Thomas then drained a three from the corner with 4 minutes, 43 seconds left. After freshman forward Jacoby Thompson, 26 points, scored on a drive for Arcadia, Farndorf again nailed a three to keep it a 7-point game. His third three came with 1 minute 58 seconds to play, giving Central a 77-70 lead. Grant Mattingly had all 17 of his points in the first three quarters. The Mattingly brothers were confident they could come through down the stretch when they cooled off. "These guys have been in big playoff games," said John Mattingly, who made 4 3-pointers. "They already know what they need to do in tough games like this. We've played like that all season." Central, a 5A team, will face number 5 Sandra Day O'Connor, a 6A team, on February 20th. The Eagles defeated number 28 Tucson 68-60. Here are the results in the other first-round open games played February 18th. Losing teams fall back into their conference tournaments. Number 1 seed Phoenix Sunnyslope and number 2 Goodyear Millennium ranked 5th and 6th in the nation by Max Preps this week and easily won their openers. Sunnyslope defeated Peoria Centennial 78-37, and number 2 Millennium beat Canyon View 101-53. Sunnyslope next plays host to number 16 Phoenix Mountain Point, while Millennium takes on number 15 Chandler. Number 3, Phoenix St. Mary's got past 4-time defending state champion Gilbert Perry 69-57 and will meet number 19 Gilbert Campo Verde in the second round at home on February 20th. Perry, which won the first 3 years of the AIA's Open, falls back into the 6A tournament. Campo Verde sent Avondale West Point to the 6A field with a 55-44 win. There will be a rematch of the 6A championship game on February 20th when Phoenix Brophy Prep plays host to Mesa in a matchup of 8-9 seeds. Brophy beat number 95 ALA Queen Creek 72-59, and Mesa escaped number 24 Scottsdale Saguaro 70-66. Number 20 Peoria Liberty sent number 13 Tucson Saguaro to the 4A bracket with a 67-56 victory, setting up a February 20th meeting at number 4 Chandler Basha. at 97-65 winner over number 29 El Mirage Dysart. Number 11 Willow Canyon will travel to take on number 6 Gilbert Highland after Willow knocked off number 22 Vale Cienega 73-56, and Highland defeated number 27 Flagstaff Coconino 78-58. Number 7 Glendale Deer Valley will play host to number 10 Gilbert Higley in the second round. Deer Valley turned back number 26 Buckeye Verado 74-56, and Higley beat number 23 Avondale Westview 77-61. Time now to take a look at the horoscopes. If you're in Aries, March 21st to April 19th, a new chapter seeds today. Feeling a profound shift, Saturn conjoining Neptune initiates you into a slow and sacred beginning. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, what are you ready to dissolve to move into a new era? Own your inner authority. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, it may be time to curate your social world. Is your community aligned with the person you're growing into? For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, look out into the distance 30 years from now. What do you want to be known for achieving? For Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, feeling the call to expand, to grow, you may have to narrow your choices. Select your options wisely. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, transformative energies surround you. But first, a reality check may push you toward what has to be done. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, a shift in relational power or responsibility is imminent. Saturn meeting Neptune aims to restructure your interpersonal frameworks. For Scorpio, October 24th to November 21st, a habit or responsibility may reach its natural end. Honor where you're exhausted. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, are you taking your desires seriously? Your inner child may have a dream that it wants you to realize. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, your home and family life are under construction. Letting go is necessary to lay a new, solid foundation. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, an inspired idea wants you to take it seriously. Are you doubting that your vision can be something real? And finally, Pisces, February 19th to March 20th, your material foundations want to be rebuilt from the ground up. And time now for Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I met Bobby, not the real name, when we were in college in the 1970s. We fell in love, got married, and stayed together for 7 years. Things changed. Our divorce was amicable. We went on to successful professional lives and happy second marriages. We stayed in touch over the years, mostly through holiday cards. A few years ago, I started getting emails from Bobby about things and ideas we shared together. She lost her husband earlier this year, and I lost my wife about the same time. I stopped by to see her last summer during a visit with some other friends, and we had a nice visit over brunch. She looked good. Would I be crazy to see if I could rekindle our relationship after 50 years? She lives a long way away now, but I've thought several times about moving back to the area where I grew up. It's clear we still share the ideals of our youth, and I'll admit I've always had a soft spot for her. Signed, Looking Back in Wyoming. Dear Looking Back, I don't think it would be crazy at all to explore rekindling your relationship with her, but please take your time. If you want to move back to the area where you grew up, keep that issue separate from the romance. It would be unfortunate if you relocated, things didn't work out for you as you had hoped, you had given up all of your social contacts, and you had to start completely over solo. And dear Abby, my son married my daughter's best friend, Kayla. I have loved this young lady since she was a little girl. When Kayla became part of the family, I was overjoyed. Kayla and my son now have a baby, and I am not allowed to see the child. The only people who get to see the baby are Kayla's mother and her mother's family. Kayla's parents are divorced. so her father doesn't see his grandchild often either. But it's far more often than my husband and I do. I wrote a text to my son. It wasn't a nice one. But please remember, I haven't been able to see my grandchild. I don't know what to do. I'm heartbroken. I did tell them I was sorry and I shouldn't have written what I did, but they still keep me at arm's length. In addition, they have just announced that I'm going to be a grandmother again. I'm not overjoyed about the news, knowing what it's been like with the first child. I'm sure it will be more of the same with the new baby. I love my grandchildren and their parents, but I'm tired of being the bad guy. Advice? Signed, Kept Away in Tennessee. Dear Kept Away, it's not unusual for new mothers to gravitate toward their own mothers after the birth of a child. I wish you had mentioned what may have caused a rift between you and Kayla, whom you say you have loved since she was a little girl. Because apologizing to your son and daughter-in-law was not enough to assuage their anger, you're finally going to have to accept that this regrettable situation is one you cannot change on your own. And if you'd like to contact Dear Abby, you can write her at www.dearabby.com. And we have some time for a couple of comics. Let's start with Blondie. Dagwood's home from work and kind of slump-shouldered, and he says, "The boss jumped all over me for checking on the Olympics results on my computer all day." Dagwood says to Blondie, "You'd think I wasn't keeping up with my workload the way he was carrying on." And Blondie said, "Did you show him that you could do both at once?" And Dagwood says, "Oh, please. Obviously, there was no way I could do both at once." And in Beetle Bailey, Beetle is at the chow line and talking to Cookie. Cookie's holding up a spoon ready to dish stuff out to him. And he says, Beetle says, "Have you ever thought about opening a restaurant when you get out?" And Cookie smiles and says, "I have." And he slops some stuff on Beetle's tray, and Beetle says, "Don't." And we have time for one more. We'll take a look at Pickles. Earl is laying on the couch. He's got a pillow. He's talking to Nelson, who's kind of laying on the back of the couch. And Earl says, "It's nice being the man of the house, Nelson. You look around, you think, I am the king of all I see." And then the cat steps on his face. And his wife walks in and says, "Earl, get your shoes off the sofa." And he looks up at Nelson and then says, "I am the king of all I see, except for Grandma and the cat." And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under Broadcast Info and Audio.